This time of year, you're going to find me jigging for crappies off my father-in-law's boat, celebrating a successful turkey hunt, or just sitting on the back deck watching time go by with a quality cigar from Thompson Cigar. Thompson Cigar has been around since 1915, offering the widest array of cigars and cigar accessories at very affordable prices. Thompson Cigar offers your favorite brands like Swisher Sweets, Cohiba, Backwoods, and Monte Cristo shipped fresh directly to your door. Also, be sure to check out their 5-pack fever deals and join their value club for big savings. Visit thompsoncigar.com and enter the discount code SE at checkout for 20% off of all orders over $75. Thompson Cigar, quality cigars at affordable prices. You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable. Since 1988, Whitetail Institute has been perfecting annual and perennial seed products specifically for hunters who plant food plots. Their seeds have been engineered to be palatable, high in protein, and extremely attractive to deer. Whether you live in the Deep South or Midwest farm country, they have products that will help you grow your best food plot yet. For more information about their seeds and their blends, visit whitetailinstitute.com. Enter the discount code SE15 for 15% off.
Welcome to Maximize Your Hunt, the podcast dedicated to those who want the most out of their hunting property. This podcast explores land management, habitat improvement, and hunting strategies that will help you maximize your time in the field. Follow along as industry professionals that live and breathe whitetail deer share their secrets to success. And now, the founder of Whitetail Landscapes, your host, John Teeter.
Hi, I'm John Teeter, Whitetail Landscapes. This is Maximize Your Hunt. Welcome back, everybody. Hopefully everybody's doing well. I appreciate everybody listening. We're nearing deer season. I am in between my last client, and I'm excited to do a little hunting here coming up. I've got some deer that I'm starting to target, getting some intel on them, making some decisions. Hopefully this week, with the weather being a little bit poor, I can do a little scouting. I'm going to get in some of the areas and hang a couple more cameras and just do a little more scouting. I'm okay pushing the limits on some of the areas that I hunt just because it's not all consistent and not every deer has started to move off their summer patterns. This morning I was watching a couple bucks spar, and one of them was a four-year-old, and he was working his way against a two-year-old that was pretty stout two-year-old buck, and it's just interesting just to look at some of the dynamics. So the deer are starting to form, you know, a bit of a pecking order and finding their locations where they're going to exist in the fall and moving off particular areas. I think that four-year-old deer, I believe is a four-year-old, is one of the bucks that I passed last year as a three-year-old. So it's good to see him improve. I think he's put on a few inches, and I wouldn't guess his score right now, but he's not a bad deer for my particular area. You know, I think a lot of the bucks in that area, probably, you know, the 3 and 4 year olds that we're watching are probably in that, anywhere between maximum, I'd say maximum, some of the four-year-olds are in that 120 range. Most of them are in that 110, 115, 120. I killed a buck a couple of years ago that was 90 inches, and it was a hell of a four-year-old buck, just body-wise. So, you know, those are the kind of deer that we're living with and promoting in our areas. And that's another piece of it is I hear all these discussions in all these forums and about, you know, how I was no different from the rest of the world. I can highly dispute that point of view tremendously just based on environmental conditions and climatic differences. But when it boils right down to it, the culture of hunting is different in all these different areas. You know, I get to experience, I've been to 5 states this year, and you know, I wish it was 2 or 3, but it's been good to travel. So I've had to do a little more traveling than I'm used to. But in those different states that I've worked in, and I've been in some states, you know, multiple times this year, and I've got to see the culture amongst those areas. And there's definitely a different culture in each area that I go to. And, you know, where I grew up and where I live, my area is not very deer centric. There's a big emphasis on shooting a lot of deer, and there isn't a big emphasis on quality. And quality, in my mind, is having the right population dynamic, buck to doe ratios, and number of deer in the landscape where we're not depleting the landscape. And we're looking at age class as a factor of that and how able we are to promote various age classes. I mentioned this, I think, maybe in another podcast, talk just about what the current situation is. And I look at those 1 and 2 year old cohorts of bucks and I try to do a little bit of statistic analysis on them to see, you know, what is my pass rate to the next age class on average? You know, how many deer are we recruiting into that next age class? And then starting to think about what my future will be like based on those particular areas. And that will change what I focus on from a target standpoint. And so, you know, hopefully this year, you know, I've got a chance to see a 4-year-old, maybe even a 5-year-old for that matter. You know, there's deer that have gone around and come around that have disappeared that sometimes come back. And I think some of you have probably experienced that. I'm going to talk a lot about design today. I'm going solo before our technical series. We're going to talk about design. And I have been all over working and traveling and thinking and coming up with some really good ideas and some framework for you all to go off of. And so here's what I want you to do. Let's pretend you're in your tree stand this year, your sit spot. One of the examples I gave earlier in a different podcast, you're in your sit spot and you're looking across the landscape. You're trying to make decisions. Every time I drive down the road, I look at different areas and I think about, hey, that area, it presents a problem set and can I solve it? Or that area that is productive, can it be more productive? Or why is it not productive? And so I look at these individual areas and I start to address at a high level, you know, what I want it to look like, what I think the issue may or may not be in that particular area, and how we can change some of these individual dynamics in a particular microbiome such that they're more productive and I have more potential. And so this is, you're in your sit spot, you're thinking about an area, and you're trying to make some decisions. So I want to give you some guidelines or framework to start to think about to build the best systems. And I'm going to give you 2 key elements to design that will change the way that you build a property. And those are the most important elements, far greater than anything you have ever watched on YouTube. There's only 2 of them that I'm going to share at the end of this podcast. So I'll save that for the end. So let's think about our properties in simplistic form. We always think of yield when it comes to crappie, all right? And so how many bushels per acre did I get out of a particular crop? They think of output. They don't think about the nutrient complexity of that plant or anything like that. I mean, they do in the cycle of growth. But when it comes to generally, we measure success in size and dimension. And you know, that's not the right methodology. Most of us would want to look at these environments in a more complex kind of mindset. And a lot of agronomists, you know, that's what they have to focus in on. They have to look at the dynamics of the environmental conditions and the soil and the material base of the soil that they're working with and come up with a strategy and how to complex that well enough where it's going to function well with the plants that we're employing in the landscape. But monocultures and crops and these crop rotations that we see most of the time, it's usually beans and corn. Well, I don't think animals were designed just to eat beans and corn. And I'm sure that the grain that we offer some of the cattle that has high degrees of pesticides and herbicides that are very present in that animal's diet are not a good thing. And so just like us, and I'll think about an apple orchard that's down the road for me, I watch that apple orchard all year long. I live and go past that apple orchard weekly, and I watch the amount of herbicide and fungicide that they spray in those apples. I wouldn't eat any of those apples. And knowing where your food comes is a big piece of this, and knowing how they manage the food through the food cycle, through its development, through its fruit cycle, is a big piece of this. I often go to my neighbor's orchard, which is next door, and there's nothing sprayed, and some of the apples look a little scabby and mealy and maybe they have bugs in them. And so maybe they're not as nutrient dense as they could be, but I know that there isn't a degree of fungicide or herbicide applied or poison applied to those. And I think any of you that were watching somebody with a hazmat suit spray these chemicals on those apples that you are therefore eating later on might think twice about consuming that particular plant. So doing things in a natural state in a natural way is a big piece of this. And I'll hit on that at the end. So I just want you to keep that in the back of your mind. Also thinking about these environments just aren't corns and beans. And if you go to a zoo, for example, a zoo may have a very diverse ecosystem presented for a particular animal. So it thrives in its cage or in its zone. But that animal is not interfacing with other animals. There's no interaction of a tiger and a monkey in the same setting. I mean, maybe some of the zoos have that, but the end result is those animals are kept separate. And so in this design and in this philosophy, insects, bugs, etc., animals are moving resources across the landscape, and there's companionship amongst the plants and animals that we're trying to promote. And so you're thinking about that in the form of design, as well as how you're trying to integrate these variations of context together. So integrating a wetland and a transitional area to a shrub thicket or shrubland area, and thinking about the index between those two and how we can optimize it for the most potential for either food or cover or combination thereof or diversity of plants. So it's being a little bit more complex, and it's not just the zoo setting where, okay, we've got a wetland area and we've got a shrubland thicket area, and those two vegetation types or habitat types are not one in the same. They're not. They're clearly not one in the same, but they interact with one another. Like, one could have resources for the other one. So it's taking the human eye while you're in that tree stand and thinking about the ecology across the landscape and the biome and making it more scalable. And here, I'll give you a small example. If you look at a log, I was on my property the other day. A big thing in my designs is focus on coarse woody debris. Coarse woody debris all over the landscape. This is a Matt Williams concept. This is my concept. This is a lot of people's concept. But we're focused, he's focused on mushrooms. I'm just focused on making sure that there's a lot of coarse woody debris in the landscape, because this is about as far as I go most times. And in that, if you take that log and you look at it decomposing, there could be a fern growing alongside of it, benefiting from that. There could be a seedling that's propagated itself in and above that log, right? It's using the nutrients from that decomposing log to replenish itself. Then you've got spiders and all sorts of bugs, and then you get the fungal mycelia all over the place once you lift that log up in the decomposing sections of that log. So that log creates this diverse ecosystem, and in and of itself, it's an entire ecosystem right in this 1 by 1 foot section. And so you see there's all this complementary actionable activity around that particular log that just literally started with coarse woody debris. And so in these design concepts, we want to add biology into it. And one of the ways you do it, I'm going to take my property, for example, which a good friend of mine told me I'm crazy, and he's right. And so I'll explain you my quick craziness. So my new property is 20 acres. I wanted to take 7 or 8 acres of that and break it up in a grid. So let's just say each one was a 1 acre section. So 7 different sections, and within that there's multiple grids, and I was going to bale graze. So I was going to take alfalfa bales from a local farm here that I could get dirt cheap, mulch hay, whatever I could get my hands on, and I was going to have a couple cattle, and I was just going to rotate them in between these paddocks, and I was going to create this paddock structure in here that was, you know, very easy to maneuver and to get deer to go to each section. And he said to me, he goes, "You're crazy." I'm like, "Why?" He goes, "One, there's a lot of maintenance with that. Two, what if the cows get out? Have you even thought about how you're going to track down these cows, and you're going to have to, you know, chase them through your neighbors, and you might have major roads nearby, and you could be dealing with car collision." I mean, there's a lot to think about in that whole decision to put cattle in the landscape that I don't think you fully address. Just because you want to add biology into an area because you want it diverse and you can use those cattle for multiple services to trample some of the non-native species, to consume some of the non-native species, to basically create a destructive environment and add biology, doesn't mean that's the best circumstance based on your individual location. So to that point is, you can add a whole bunch of different options onto your landscape and create these unbelievable systems, but it has to be contextually correct. So one of the things we're trying to create potential, I'll talk about that in a second, but we're trying to increase, you know, oxygen in the soil, increase the productivity of soils, increase maybe carbon sequestration, building habitat, human food value in and amongst these areas, increasing food production for animals. We've got to look at the context in a bigger perspective, but we got to drill down on these underutilized areas. Like when I was driving down the road saying that could be better, we need to figure out what the potential of those areas are. And I always start with soil. I've preached this enough on this podcast since probably the first 5 podcasts, is soil is critical. But we need to increase 2 things. We need to have decent drainage. We need to increase the organic material, which will increase the soil aggregation and fertility. We got to have a method and madness to dealing with drainage, good drainage, bad drainage, and collecting water. And often one I recommend for a lot of people is dig down, look at your soil complexes, and then maybe in this process, you're remediating large sections of your soil, which is a cost thing, and that's when you buy a property with good soils. You may not have as much remediation, but you're looking to turn and churn that soil so you can work it, so you can increase the aeration. It's not a bad thing using mechanical means to disturb and correct the soil. And then you can add your natural amendments in and put natural amendments in these systems that are going to function. And how do you get them to function? You get them to function with biology and plants. And those are the two other pieces of the equation that make things work. So let's talk about rewilding areas. I think I use this term, maybe I use it incorrectly or correctly. I don't remember on the podcast, but you know, rewilding the landscape is a term that I hear quite often. And I want you to think this way. When you're in that tree stand in your sit spot and you're looking across the landscape, I want organized, Josh, my partner, uses this term a lot, organized chaos. That's what logging's like. I want the improvements to be organized and organized well enough where they're going to survive. I see a lot of these projects where somebody, NRCS, comes in, they pay this person, hey, plant these trees, put these trees in a tree tube, and there's no maintenance after the fact. They haven't designed the system well enough to focus on the longest pole or the largest hole in the bottom of the bucket. They haven't plugged those things first, which typically are those keystone species. They could be oak, they could be fruit trees, they could be willow, whatever species you choose, and there should be a multitude of those in the landscapes, probably 20 to 40 of those on average. And you're thinking about a field conversion, and you're not focusing on the ones that take the longest to develop first, and working the other trees off or the other species or shrubs off that, and prioritizing those key species as the predominant focus. And the reason that is that creates a great fungal community and connection to emphasize growth amongst all those other species around it. We create these, what we call them, guilds. And there's interactions amongst plants and animals in those areas, but with a focal species that's going to dominate that particular area. And thinking about the worst mistake you can do, absolute worst design mistake, and I will criticize everybody to the high hell on this one. The worst design thing you can do is just put switchgrass in an area. If you have no cover in your entire landscape and switchgrass is your predominant form of cover, and that's what you use as a basis to keep deer in your property, I believe you've missed the boat. And I've said this before previously on other podcasts. The system of design is much more complex than that. You should have at least minimum three layers, ideally four and maximum seven. Now, I've got systems here that are probably even more than seven if you think about the design. But when I talk about layers, I'm talking about, you know, overstory layer, a midstory layer, and a lower, maybe shrub layer, those three layers. Those are pretty basic parameters. Now, grass could be a combination of grass, shrubs. But if you're just putting in grasses and you're going in an area and later denuding, creating these small crop circles, and there being a focal point for deer, you've kind of missed the boat, because switchgrass should not be a dominant species across the entire landscape. It can be a component of it, but you need to set thresholds amongst those various three or four layers that have good companionship, that create good form and function on the landscape that deer will relate well to. And a switchgrass stand, in my opinion, would not be the first choice in that equation. All right, but letting areas be organized, but then over time, making sure that you do allow areas to go wild. And you may have to initially refocus some of those areas because some things have taken over, et cetera. So rewilding the landscape might mean looking at how things develop and leaving areas unattended, but paying attention to those and organizing those other trees and putting a predominant focus on some of those other species across the landscape. So let's talk more about function and fruit trees as a good example. You know, if you're putting fruit trees out in the landscape, we want to typically attract pollinators, which, you know, increasing the insect or insect resources on the landscape are really, really important. I listened to this podcast this morning. It was all about bugs and rebugging the landscape. And it was really just an interesting, you know, plethora of information and thinking about how bugs have this negative connotation and how we kill bugs in our homes and we try to eliminate our homes and this whole mindset of creating these environments that are almost sterile and denuding everything and killing everything. Like if I told somebody, you know, from a common sense standpoint, if I said, okay, on that apple orchard that we were mentioning earlier, they go in and they spray all these fungicides and herbicides and they have hazmat suits. If I said that person, they did that six times a year to manage that particular area, and forget if it's six or two or one, but they did it more than one time. I believe that every single human being that actually heard me say that would say, I'm not sure I want to eat that particular material. I mean, essentially what they're doing is they're applying poisons on the landscape to kill things. And so anybody that's willing to ingest poison, and maybe you are, is certainly has a death wish. And I think most of us are trying to live and not die. And certainly, you know, take that into consideration when you're applying herbicide in the landscape. But also realizing that, you know, there's the other mantra of we need to make changes. And sometimes changes in and of itself, they're simple changes. They may require a little bit of herbicide to reset these areas. You can't always kill a grass setting completely with fire or disturbance, you know, mechanical disturbance. You may have to use other means to get rid of those particular plants. But also thinking about the companionship. So there's a dynamics in proximity where there's these fruit trees, but you need other species that are blossoming in and around at different times that are consistently attracting pollinators. So in my example earlier, if I had a fruit tree example where I wanted a lot of these pollinators in and around, I may have honeyberry or some other species, comfrey, some of these other species that are flowering at different times that are going to create an attraction all season long. And that's the same thing with our food plots. So if you're just planting this monocrop of corn or beans, their level of attraction is going to wane over time. And that doesn't seem very conducive or high level productivity. And in order to create abundance, we need to think of abundance over time, not just, hey, this is going to feed my deer in the fall. We need to think about how are we feeding these deer and other insects, et cetera, across the entire period of time. And so we have to make these good decision processes around picking plants and thinking about the general symbiosis of trees that have co-evolved together. And some of the examples I've given earlier that you typically hear, the oak hickory forest, and there's synergies between those trees, and there's mycorrhizal connections, and there's quorum sensing and sensing amongst the microbes that work in and around those trees that create this great interaction where these plants work off each other, a parent-child relationship, or, you know, a sibling relationship or cousin relationship. There's synergies amongst those particular plants. But it's also thinking about the dynamics on how each plant provides ecosystem function to another particular plant. And we'll get into an example of that towards the end when I tell you my secret sauce to improving landscapes. So the decision process is really simple. We want hardy plants that can deal with the climate, that are suitable to the soils, that can deal with the sun regime, and pick plants based on the layering we talked about earlier, kind of those three layers, the overstory, the midstory, and the lower story, and make sure that they function in synergy. And also, when you have more sun on a site, you can have more layering in that effect. You know, if we have an environment like I do more than likely on a property I'm working on right now is, actually I'm doing design on one right now. We're doing a woodland environment, and in my areas, woodlands were quite common in certain areas, and creating these woodland environments where these old wolf trees and making sure we have complementary plants in and around these woodland species and make sure the thinning is appropriate. So we're balancing that sunlight, in some of these areas where we get a really direct south sun. And so it's just kind of creating these ideal environments for food resources and cover resources in and amongst a savanna or a woodland that can be very beneficial to the deer that you're trying to harvest and increase their abundance in those particular areas. But let's always think about potential. So every system has the potential to be very functional. And when you're building these functional ecosystems, we don't just focus on monocrops, like I said earlier, or just a hedgerow. I did a podcast on hedgerows where there's a particular species in that hedgerow, and I'm talking about tree or shrub species. And when you put in fruit trees and you add a shrub layer or ground cover, it has to be organized and diversified. And we're trying to do two things in those equations. We are building the porosity or ability to accept and exploit air and water in those particular areas. And so once we increase the ability to drain and hold water with the high levels of organics, we create micropore spaces that are essentially holding water, balancing the oxygen levels, and we create a storage of nutrients. And if we do that correctly, what's going to happen is we're going to increase those plants' yield. And if we increase yield, what we increase is we increase the offsets or the additional components of that yield. So as a plant grows, what does it do? It sheds its roots, which increases organic material matter in the soil. And then what do? The plant, as it grows, it drops leaves. So we increase resources that provide cover for insects and organic material on the soil surface. And then what do? Is we have trees that are shedding branches all the time. And those are big, high-level remedial nutrients that are going to be later absorbed and provide protection and food resources for all host of insects, including the plant that just dropped its branches. So it just provides a plethora of functional functional aspects in the system that are going to benefit. And we want to create this ideal state where, you know, we're building energy, and that's how we build energy with these particular trees. The thing that I mentioned earlier is we want to accelerate succession. There's a design philosophy, maybe I'll introduce it this summer, is how do we increase succession? One of the biggest mistakes that I see clients make, and I know this is because of YouTube and people promoting food plots, is they go in an area and they totally denude the area of any vegetation whatsoever. So they go in, it's almost like a bomb going off. It's like a nuclear bomb. And in that area, we've destroyed everything. We've ripped the ground. We've taken out all the stones. You know, we've removed all the root material, and we basically denuded an area. I was talking to Jim Ward a couple of years ago, and him and I have a really similar philosophy. I think we've talked a little bit on the podcast. You cut a stump, and then you harvest portions of that stump. You take out the root flare. You start digging down deep, and you on your property, you already have these laid out mulch and compost areas, and you already have soil available to you that you've built over time, and you use that as a means to cover some of those stumps. You're not disturbing some of the fungal communities, which eventually will be destroyed by that plant dying, but there's going to be decomposing material in and around that plant, and that decomposing material is very important for the ecological function and system. And so as we start to take this extraction mentality, we're pulling all these resources out when we're logging, we're caught chopping off stems and taking off tops, and we're cutting firewood. We're taking resources that took a long time to build. And so losing those carbon-rich resources can be a problem to sustaining and increasing the energy within our forest stands. So what we want to do is we want to have a good philosophy on what we leave and what we take. And that's part of my job, is to figure out not taking too much, but leaving the right amount. And in this extraction mindset, which has to deal with a lot of things related around economics, we are taking many times out more than we need to, but not realizing the amount that we've took, we're not actually replenishing, and we're letting nature do it itself. And that takes a long time. And I want to speed up that process. I don't want to slow it down. So we need to have these living examples of habitats that have high resources and are very nutrient dense, or producing nutrient dense food resources. And some of that could be you benefiting from it. So if you plant a tree because you removed a tree, and that's my philosophy been with my kids. If we remove a tree, we plant a tree, and we plant a tree intelligently that meets kind of the hardiness requirements, all the things I mentioned earlier. But we can take that tree, and if it's a fruit tree, we can harvest the cyanwood out of it. If it's a chestnut tree, we can take the seeds and replenish them on the landscape. If it's an oak producing tree or an acorn producing tree, an oak, we can take some of those seedlings and move them around the landscape. So we have the ability to rewild these areas and move things around as we so please based on the design. And it's not taking things off the landscapes, it's adding things to the landscape. So hopefully that makes sense. Let me talk quickly about succession. And there's a bunch of ways to accelerate succession. And a lot of times it's adding plants to an area, establishing the right volume of plants in an area. So there's different tropic levels where there's overstory, understory, and belowstory species that are promoting and sequestering carbon and photosynthesizing at a high rate. And there's just diversity of those species. And there isn't a dominance of one versus the other. And in some of the field setting designs, and this is where, again, we lack in knowledge some of these YouTube guys is, hey, I go in, I'm going to put a diversity pocket in, and they plant like four species of trees, and they have no idea why they plant them. It's just a diversity pocket. There's a lot of stuff going in there. We're just going to put a switchgrass stand in here because we need habitat. We need cover in a particular area. And what we're focusing on is having the right volume of cover in a particular area such that that cover in and of itself really provides an opportunity. And that cover can't just be a non-food type cover. It just seems way too simple in design. And I emphasize, do not focus on the property that is an island property that has strictly switchgrass as a means of cover to hold deer. I'm not saying switchgrass won't hold deer. I'm saying that is very non-complex in design, and we can be idyllic in creating an environment that supports long-term energy building and that meets the form, function, and potential that I mentioned earlier of creating these high energy resources for the animals. But here's an example. on a property they worked on recently. It's a property out in the Adirondack area. And it's an old farm. And we went in and we came up with the concept of introducing swales. And if anybody doesn't know what a swale is, basically it's a kind of a pit mound system where you have basically a trench and use some of that material to create a berm. And we use it sometimes to infiltrate. We use it to move water for many different resources. And the berm, in some cases, we want them a little more porous so they're not highly compacted. So we can either plant trees on or below the berm, and we're using that as a resource to collect and move water in the landscape. And so this ability to increase water across the landscape basically increases, in many cases, organic matter levels in the soil, and it leads to higher levels of microorganisms in around those water-rich areas. And what does that mean? More plant biomass and more photosynthetic energy going that's available, that's actually working itself and exudating itself into the soil, providing long-term humus, which is the resource that all plants and microbes want to feed themselves. And so that's a really big piece of it. And it's just managing water in the landscape. And so one of the key elements to design is making sure that you have as much water on the property as possible. Putting in ditching or subsoiling massive areas, being a little bit, we'll just say, intense or overly involved in getting water off the landscape is a bad thing. Drain tile, in most cases, is a bad thing. And if you could hold more water in the landscape, particularly in the areas that are experiencing serious drought, particularly in the Midwest, or having water pools in around these areas would be really good. And people are now saying, oh, we don't want water areas because it's creating, you know, areas for midges. And ask yourself this question. Most predator and prey relationships ebb and flow. And midges in high abundance are a function of the environments that are in. They have less predators managing them in the landscape. And predator could be a dragonfly, it could be fish, etc. So in these natural environments, we're trying to solve the problem, but we're doing it by creating the idea that we can add something into an area. Like we can add herbicide or fungicides or what have you, whatever the example is. Or we're adding in this EHD chemical that's going to treat this particular area, and it's going to eliminate this midge from this particular zone. Well, healthy soils and therefore healthy environments and human interaction in a positive way could actually eliminate the midge in totality from forming negative relationships with animals like deer. So not to get on the EHD topic, probably a topic for another day, but there's a big emphasis on these diseases and their impacts, and thinking about something that creates a negative virus within a particular animal, and thinking about that interaction or changing that interaction can be done in many different ways. And it's having these healthy water resources in amongst our landscape, and it's not polluting those as well. So using some of the chemicals that we use to pollute those could be in some shape, way, or form creating this negative interaction where the midge benefits and therefore it takes over a particular area. And guess what? The midge is biting the animal and the animal's dying. So, you know, you might think about the root of the problem rather than just trying to find a solution. And a quick fix solution has never worked well in almost any example that I've seen. And this example of adding swales is just a means of collecting water and moving water in the landscape. And that seems pretty easy. It's a pretty simple equation and something you can do. The other key thing, and I'll at the end of this, I'm going to give an example of how we build complex systems, is air. I mentioned earlier micro and macro porosity, or micro or macro forms of porosity in our soils. And the focus there was to allow water and air to get into those areas and balancing those in and around plants. And so having really highly compacted soils really don't do much from a benefit to your particular habitat, your soil habitat. So that is the two key ingredients to increasing energy on our landscape. It's just those two. It's not more complicated. It's not adding this or that. It's increasing those. I've been on multiple properties where we've changed the water regime and all of a sudden we get biomass in abundance, higher levels of organic material, and it's just managing water. If you manage water in your property, I guarantee you 100 times over that your property will be far productive than any neighbor's property if you just manage it appropriately. All right. So that's my little secret there at the end. And I know it seems pretty basic, but those are the key ingredients to success. So diversity, and that was a big piece of this when we started. I'm just going to give you a quick example. Now, I don't know if I've spoke about this, but I love Jerusalem artichoke. And Jerusalem artichoke is one of those particular plants that provides a lot of resources. And one of the things I've used it for is screening. I've used it for screening in the food plots. The deer do eat the plant. They eat the bulb of the plant. It kind of looks like a potato. And it provides a good pollination opportunity. So it has multiple functions, but it also does a really nice job of creating a screen. And it's a screen. It creates a screen height that's really, really good and dense. Eventually it degrades through the winter months, but it'll create movement and flow. And it's a perennial plant in the landscape. So using that, which is a forb, and it's exudating carbon, it's just doing a lot in the landscape. It becomes this great resource in and around apple trees. And I use it to shield the south-facing sun where I planted all my fruit trees or crab apple trees or pear trees, so I don't have to put any latex paint on the bottom of the stem. I think that's just a great little additional tangential gain from that particular plant. But just think about that on the landscape. So when we're building, we'll say, a diverse set of plants and multiple layers, so this would be an overstory tree, like a fruit tree, an apple tree, chestnut tree, maple tree, what have you. We want to have a bunch of other plants that are around it, adding diversity. And some of those are example like comfrey. I add comfrey around a lot of my fruit trees, and I space it so the comfrey eliminates grass intrusion. There's some plants that have such deep roots that it eliminates grasses from intruding in and around that particular plant. And then I take that comfrey and I chop and drop it. So I use that resource at two intervals during the year, and I take that and I put it around. And I eliminate other plants from growing adjacent to the trees that I'm trying to promote. So basically like a mulch. And then I add other things like chives that are, you know, that eliminate, you know, pests, or false indigo, which is a plant that does really, really well for producing nitrogen in and around some of the fruit trees. Or bee balm, which is a highly attracted flowering plant that that does well in a pollinating environment. So you can add some of these individual species in and around your fruit trees to make them more functional. So hopefully this makes sense. I want to end it here. I threw a lot into this podcast, and I know this is, you know, us prepping before hunt season. So I want you to get in your soot spot, which is your tree stand, and start thinking about things that you can do on your landscape. Start thinking about the improvement cycles you can make. And don't just think about the monocrops, the crop rotations, the beans, corn. Those are too simple for our environments. They're too basic. They require too much input and too much management. Think about simpler management systems that are going to get you ahead. The last thing I'm going to mention, please go in and give this podcast a 5-star review. I really feel like for the volume of content that we're providing, this is far greater than any habitat podcast, hunting podcast there is. I really don't think there's anything even comparable to what we're doing. So I hope you also feel the same. And if you have advice and guidance or things you want to hear, I'm always open to that. I'm always open to sharing and thinking about things differently. But for those that go in for Apple iTunes, and give a 5-star review and comment, you will have a chance to get a 5x7 Whitetail Landscapes. It's a thick, just an awesome looking bumper/window sticker. It is awesome. I just got them in recently. I'm going to send those out free of charge to you. Thank you for supporting the podcast. Please go in and give it a review. There'll be other opportunities if you don't use Apple iTunes to win one of these. But that's what I'm offering to folks that listen to the podcast. Please do that. Please go in and give a 5-star review. The more reviews I get, the more, and the audience grows from this. Please share this with your friends and constituents, everyone you know, your colleagues. Please grow this podcast. We've become, I think, one of the largest habitat podcasts based from the data that I'm getting from the network and the industry. And I'm fortunate for that. And it's because we have devout listeners, people that want to participate, that are growing and gaining from the information we're providing. It's just about thinking differently, thinking holistic, ecosystem management, all the things we talked about today. And so I appreciate you all listening to me. I wish you all good luck this hunting season. We're going to get in our technical series next. So pay attention to all the questions and things that the individuals are thinking about explaining. And let's have a great hunt season this year. Thanks, everybody. See ya.
Maximize Your Hunt is a production of Whitetail Landscapes. For more information on how John Teeter and his team of experts can help you maximize your hunt, check out whitetaillandscapes.com.
Two Good & Co. coffee creamers are made with farm-fresh cream, real milk, and contain 3 grams of sugar per serving. That's 40% less than the 5 grams per serving in leading traditional coffee creamers for a rich, delicious experience. Whether you enjoy your coffee hot, cold, bold, or frothy, Two Good coffee creamers make every sip a good one. Two Good coffee creamers, real goodness in every sip. Find them at your local Kroger in the creamer aisle.
You saw the game-winning play once, but have to replay it 3 times on the way back to the hotel. Because some moments don't end at the buzzer. Life's a trip. Make the most of it at Best Western. Book direct and save at bestwestern.com.
President's Day savings are happening now at the Home Depot with up to 40% off select appliances. Looking to upgrade your fridge? Check out LG's newest model, serving up ice in all kinds of styles. Cube, crushed, craft ice, and now new mini craft ice straight from the dispenser. From cold brew to fizzy favorites, these refrigerators will have you entertaining like a pro. Shop President's Day savings and get up to 40% off, plus free delivery on select appliances like LG at the Home Depot. Free delivery on appliance purchases of $1,498 or more. Offer valid February 5th through the 25th. U.S. only. See store online for details.
The world moves fast. Your workday, even faster. Pitching products, drafting reports, analyzing data. Microsoft 365 Copilot is your AI assistant for work. Built into Word, Excel, PowerPoint, and other Microsoft 365 apps you use. Helping you quickly write, analyze, create, and summarize. So you can cut through clutter and clear a path to your best work. Learn more at Microsoft.com/N365Copilot.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.